With a sideways look at history, including discussions, reviews of alternate history media, and your comments, this is the Alternate History Show with Ben Kearns.
And welcome to the second of these programmes, delving into what might have happened had things played out differently. We do apologise for the slight hiatus of programmes over the last couple of months, though we are back with a vengeance today, talking about none other than the Fab Four. In particular, what if the Beatles had never met in Liverpool back in 1957? What if they remained the Quarrymen beyond the late 50s? How would they have been affected by Decca Records signing them back in early 1962? Imagine the Beatles with Decca Recordings but sans George Martin. What about if the lineup had consisted of John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison and Pete Best? How would the Beatles' career have developed had Brian Epstein survived 1967? Could their demise have been prevented? Could they have still been recording music in the 70s and beyond? And how close did we come to a potential Beatles reunion in 1975? And could it have happened sooner or afterwards, perhaps had John Lennon survived his assassination? We have a look at all those questions in some detail at the very least over the course of the next 90 minutes. Plus, we'll be summarising a couple of timelines in the alternate history forums, including the story of how the Beatles continued into the 70s, and a Beatles story with an alternate point of departure in 1967 with John Lennon on a roof. All that to come. Plus, we'll be having a look at the man who is known as the guy who turned down the Beatles. But how much is true and how much is myth regarding Dick Rowe? And we'll have a look at his illustrious music career aside from not signing the Beatles as well, and what he did with his life afterwards. And who did he sign as he was head honcho of Decca Recordings? All that coming up. Plus, it's been a busy time of it on the alternate timelines website. We'll be checking in with Alex Wallace in the feedback hub, and we'll look at your suggestions as to the future of this show and what we should be doing in the next few months or so. That is all here. I hope you can stick around and listen into the program over the course of the next hour and a half.
This is the Alternate History Show. We revisit the past, change it, and see what happens. Enough said.
Okay, so if I were to ask you to tell me the first name that comes into your head when you think of music from the 1960s, chances are I'd be getting a variety of responses right now. Some of you may recite the likes of the Rolling Stones or the Animals, particularly those who are fans of blues and rock music of the time. Meanwhile, soul enthusiasts may tell me all about any one of the artists that Berry Gordon was managing at Motown in the 1960s, such as Smokey Robinson, Stevie Wonder, The Supremes, The Four Tops, or even Marvin Gaye. If you're a fan of protest music, you may tell me about Bob Dylan, particularly if you're a folk fanatic. And if you're an ultra-pedant show-off like myself, you may plump for someone such as Velvet Fog, The Penthouse Five, or The Ugly Ducklings. Well, they were the Rolling Stones' favourite band of the time anyway. However, it's fair to say a lot of you may go for the Beatles, perhaps even a majority of you. The composer Aaron Copland put it best when he said, if you want to understand the 60s, you should listen to the work of the Beatles. And we're going to be talking about the work of the Beatles in the next hour and a half, as I said at the beginning of the show, wondering what might have happened had things gone differently for the band. Luckily, I'm joined by a special guest to try and deduce what may have taken place. Please introduce yourself.
Am I very special?
Well, you'll do.
Hello, my name's Black and the Borg. I do some posting on the Alternate History Discussion Board. Sometimes I make good content and sometimes I don't. It's really that simple.
And no doubt some of them are positively indifferent.
Yeah, probably. That's how the universe works. I'm also a, I've been a a bit obsessive about the Beatles since I was age 13, so I do have an endless encyclopedic knowledge of them, and I thought I would contribute to this whole thing.
Needless to say, I tend to take full advantage of your encyclopedic knowledge of the Fab Four over the course of the next hour and a bit. Before we move on to the crux of the programme, though, which is, of course, the Beatles, I want to know about your username. Ask this of everyone who corresponds on this particular show. Where on earth does the username Black and the Borg come from? How did you come to use that username? I'm curious.
When I was younger, I was doing a school project and I had to come up with a load of weird usernames for like fake people having a chat discussion. And I just chucked a load of words on paper and saw what stick. And for some odd reason, I really liked this particular username. So now I use that one.
Let's move on to what we're meant to be talking about, shall we? The Beatles. And let's start, as we should do, I suppose, at the very beginning in 1957, when they historically met. I mean, is there a way of preventing, I'm sure there is a way of preventing their meeting, or at least preventing them becoming so close and sort of jamming together and thinking, do you know what, musically this could work. So if we go back to 1957 and they don't exist.
Yes, I see you also saw the film yesterday.
Do you know what? I haven't actually seen the film. Anyway, moving on, because I want to explore how we could have prevented or how the Beatles might not have met each other in this scenario. Let's suppose, as I think nearly did happen actually, John Lennon moves to New Zealand with his dad. Tell us what would have hurt. Tell us about that story.
During one of his visitations, Alf Lennon, who was the senior Lennon, the father, brought his son to Blackpool, which is like a holiday area in the United Kingdom. John Lennon remembers riding on the donkeys there, because apparently Blackpool has donkeys, I'm not too sure. But then, in a twist ending, he went, oh yeah, also we're moving to New Zealand right now, let's go. But luckily, his mum and Auntie Mimi caught wind of this, drove down to Blackpool as quick as they could, and stopped him as they were about to board. And John Lennon, but who, by the way, was 4 years old at the time, was forced to make the decision, do you want to live with your mum or do you want to live with your dad? And he initially chose his dad, but as he dragged John off, he saw his mum crying, and then he went, oh no, and ran back to his mum, and that was pretty much it.
Okay, so if we presuppose that Lennon does move to New Zealand, how exactly, I mean, do the others, Paul, George, and Ringo, I think I know the answer to this in part at least, but do the three of them at any point meet, and do they meet with any success without John's influence?
Well, that's also interesting, because prior to knowing John Lennon, George and Paul were school friends, I think from the ages about 8 or 9, they had known each other for a while, so there would have been a pre-existing link. I'm not sure if that would have manifested in them becoming a band or anything, but there would have been some form of success, probably. As for Ringo, I'm not too sure what would become of him, because they all met when they went to Hamburg in Germany. So the butterflies would have immediately kicked in.
Okay, so all this, the Beatles not forming as we know it, begs the question, which is what we're trying to get at this point in the programme at least, without the Beatles, would the 60s still swing?
Well, I think it would have had some sort of swinging adjacent type cultural miasma, considering that regardless of the Beatles, we would have had the innovations such as the birth control pill and LSD, that sort of thing. You would have seen something very similar emerge. However, the Beatles had a particularly large stake in the subculture because, you know, they did Sgt. Pepper's and that kind of became the universal symbol of the swinging 60s. You know, all the colorful fashion. They were kind of the trendsetters. If they were doing something, the rest of the world took note and went, I'm going to do that too. So in their wake, there probably would have been some sort of successor group such as that. I think the Beach Boys might have gone a bit off the handle. Maybe the Rolling Stones would have been more influential in the United Kingdom. But it would have been noticeably different. There's noticeable differences between the two groups. With the Beach Boys, they were very Swedish sugar vocal harmonies. I don't like to have sex with these women. I like to hold their hands instead. That kind of thing. They felt like they were trying to say abstinence is cool in the most covert way possible. So after a period of time, I think their music stylings would become more unappealing to the majority of new teenagers that emerged in the 1960s, considering that they're a new breed. They're very anti-government, anti-establishment, very experimental. Yet the Beach Boys were like, no, let's go surfing in our hot rods. That sort of thing. They would have probably gravitated more to the Rolling Stones in that regard because, well, first of all, they are the closest analogs to the Beatles we have, and it's hypothetical. And secondly, to counter the Beatles' much more clean image of, like, suit-wearing mock tops, these dudes would run around, start fights, they'd crash the stage, they got arrested for public urination in 1964 because they were peeing behind a church, they did not know. So it's entirely possible that with these new, cool, rad dudes' attitude would have hit a note with the more disenfranchised youth of America.
And I do wonder whether, you know, the Stones would have perhaps been a bit more poppy and a slightly less rocky, not by much, but, you know, with the void of the Beatles, whether that would have happened and, you know,
well,
vice versa,
also
perhaps.
It's a very interesting dichotomy between that. The Rolling Stones started out for the longest time until, like, late 1966 as a covers band. They used to cover R&B hits and, you know, rock and roll, that sort of thing. And they didn't actually start writing their own music until Decca pressured Keith Richards and Mick Jagger to form a songwriting duo because they saw how good Lennon and McCartney were doing. And they went, we need our own in-house rival. Yeah, two new groups. So without Lennon and McCartney as an influence on the whole industry, the record label might have just been content with letting the Stones continue to do covers of Muddy Waters, that sort of thing.
Although it could be argued as well, which is the interesting thing about this alternate history, that the Rolling Stones, having seen an opening perhaps, might have gone down the songwriting route, might have tried to at least experiment with writing their own tunes and come up with something.
That is one interpretation of it, yes, but I think for the most part they were almost, I think I would actually, no, I would argue that they were entirely motivated by the fact that there was an incredibly dynamic songwriting duo present and active in the scene at the time.
Okay, so that's 1957 dealt with. Let's explore their sort of pre-big break, the run-up to the big break, I suppose, and of course the big delta before that would be the audition for Decca, and we'll come on to that in more detail a little bit later on during Almost Infamous, actually, so I won't mention his name too much, but of course Dick Rowe, it's rumoured, said, guitar bands are dying out. What if there had been a more positive atmosphere, perhaps, and Decca had decided, you know what, let's sign the Beatles along with Brian Poole and the Tremolos? What would happen then? So you'd have the Beatles with Decca Records without George Martin.
Well, actually, just before we move on to that, I had a quick thing I wanted to interject about your earlier example of John Lennon being whisked away to New Zealand. There is a very good novel out called New Hokkaido by James McNaughton, who was published in, I think, 2012. And it's an alternative history novel where the Japanese Empire conquered New Zealand during the Second World War. And as like a little side note, just like as a little added tidbit for world building, there is John Lennon as just like a background character. He was a famous New Zealand musician. He becomes like an anti-authoritarian icon in the face of the Japanese Empire ruling over this tiny little foreign country. And he ends up getting killed around the time that the novel begins. And he appears to the narrator as like a ghost So I recommend if you're interested in that scenario, you should probably check that out.
Lennon's one of those characters who does actually crop up quite a lot in the alternate history of sort of the 50s and the 60s, and anything with a point of departure starting in 1940, I suppose.
Half of the appeal of the Beatles is the grand mythology you have about them. That's why there are so many works and reinterpretations of them, because they are one of the most known groups, I would argue.
Possibly the most well-known.
Because so much of the history is known outside of the confines of history. We know like every single thing they did. It's easy to see how easy it is to alter one specific point, and then you have an entire new landscape of pop culture as a result.
Okay, let's move on. Let's move on to, say, 19.
Sorry for that tangent.
That's all good. We don't mind tangents on this program. Let's move on to 1962 then. So, as I was saying, the Beatles are signed by Decca Records in 1962.
During 1962, around that time, Decca was not very interested in guitar bands, hence the whole idea of, oh, guitars dying out. Where instead they were focusing on the whole big band thing, which was in its death throes, considering that we were moving into the mid-60s at this point, and the big band was only popular in the early 50s. They were trying to only recruit big band type groups, mostly instrumentalists.
Is it, in your view, completely impossible that they would have signed up to Decca then in 1962?
I would say yes, absolutely, because you also have to keep in mind that the thing that got them hired by EMI was the fact that George Martin, who was the studio producer who did most of their records, went down to meet with them and said, like, oh, if there's anything you don't like, just tell me. And then George Harrison piped up, oh, I don't like your tie for a start. And he almost threw them out right there and there. But then he saw that George Harrison was grinning and he went, oh, they're very funny. And then he marched back up to the studio and went, we have to hire these guys because of their humor alone. Outside of their humor, whilst, yes, they were still good and passable, they were not, they didn't have anything back then that really put them above other music groups at the time, so they were kind of expendable.
It's interesting as well, because that facilitates another thing I was thinking of earlier on. What would the career of George Martin have been like without the Beatles, of course?
There's a lot of debate on whether or not this would have amounted to anything, because both prior and during the Beatles' careers, George Martin was very involved in the orchestral side of producing. He had previously, I think outside of orchestra, he had only done production work for country groups, you know, like the old banjo plucking washboard kind of people. And during 1968, during the production of the Yellow Submarine film, he did provide an entire orchestral suite that he did compose himself. You can actually find this on side 2 of the Yellow Submarine album. It's not great if you don't like classical music, but it's still enough of a point that you could see where he would go. There's a lot of individuals who would just not come to household names if they were just left to their own devices without the Fabs.
Definitely. Okay, so we imagine now we come forward to their signing to EMI. What would the Beatles look like into the 60s when they became famous with Pete Best as a member? I mean, there are various theories as to why he was dropped.
The overarching theory to that, according to most autobiographies you can find out there, are Mark Lewisham is a very good source for this. This is Beatles tune in. The studio executives were not in any way happy with Pete Best drumming as they were recording test tracks, and Brian Epstein relayed this to the group and went, we might have to find a new drummer. And very luckily they had met Richard Starkey, better known as Ringo, in Hamburg back in the late 50s, so they knew him. And Brian rung him up and said, do you want to come down to the studio? And the rest is history, kind of. They just kind of awkwardly told Pete Best he wouldn't be in the group anymore. Well, Brian told him, actually. None of the Fabs actually met him face-to-face post-firing. And if you actually listen to Pete Best strumming in comparison to Ringo's, whilst Ringo's is a bit more simple, he does have a better tempo, a better rate. I would argue he's the superior drummer, especially in the early days. Not to mention, their friendship with Ringo became more solidified than it was to Pete Best. Pete Best was kind of, in a way that is not offensive, again, I admire the man, kind of like a auxiliary member of the group. They were not as cohesive as they were when they had Ringo. So a lot of the group interplay may have not come about in Ringo's absence, and they might have not had enough of the charisma and the in-jokes that made them so endearing to fans over the years.
There was a theory as well, actually, that Pete Best was going to be kept on as a live drummer. How feasible would that have been? I've heard vague rumours, basically. The idea, I've heard a few people say, it was at least briefly considered to keep him on as a live drummer while employing a session musician, perhaps, as the authentic drummer during the recordings. Personally, I don't see that working out particularly well, but
too many drummers spoil the broth.
Something like that, as the phrase should have been.
Considering before Ringo, now that you mention it. It does sound like an idea before one of them went, hey, hop, let's invite Ringo over.
Of course, would Pete Best, if he was kept on, would he have narrated years later a story about an engine?
That's a whole new kettle of fish that I'd even considered. Not only would we be losing the Beatles as we know them, we'd also be losing the narrator for Thomas the Tank Engine, and I can not abide by that.
So let's say their first album and their first singles, when released, Please Please Me and the like, does not perform as well as it did in real life. Let's say they don't have the image rehash, and consequently perhaps the album sales aren't quite as stellar. Perhaps still doing quite well, but not as good as in our timeline, I suppose. What would happen then?
What you're proposing is a bit of a interesting scenario, considering that the singles themselves were incredibly popular with the young people at the time. But another reason they were so successful was because of their image. Epstein got them to cut their hair down and wear some nice suits, and because of that he made them into what essentially amounts in the modern day as, like, you know, sex symbols for the TV boppers. They're like, it was half their music, half, oh my god, Paul McCartney is so dreamy, that sort of logic. Maybe if their image was not refined as much, maybe if, I don't know, John Lennon refused to put on the suit like he almost did and the rest followed, maybe they wouldn't have been as palatable to the younger audiences, and then they would have just lost interest because there would have been more clean bands like the Beach Boys or, like, I don't know, was anyone attractive to, like, Brian back in the day? Was anyone like, oh, Brian Wilson? Yes.
Not that I know of. I've yet to see some proof that that would have been the case, but yeah. I suppose
we need to find that one teenager with a poster of Brian Wilson in a bedroom.
I'm sure there's one person.
An interesting thing to note as well is the Beatles became incredibly successful after they cracked America back in 1963. One of the schemes of Brian Epstein was they were to be one of the first major British bands to do a big tour of America and get everyone on their side. But the band refused to do it until they had a number one in the charts over there, which they eventually did. Then as soon as they had a number one, they went over. If they never got a number one in the American charts, they probably would have just became like a byproduct of the era. They just probably would have fizzled out.
I was going to say, what if they had never toured America? What if they'd never gone? What if they hadn't appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show back in 1964? And I suppose the point of departure, as you're suggesting, is the lack of a number one over there. So they perhaps do quite big things over here in the UK, maybe even reach to New Zealand if we're lucky. That's all good. But they're sort of like the Kinks in a way, in a sense. Success eludes them in the US.
Brian Epstein was a very clever businessman. He knew exactly what he was doing and exactly what would appeal to the public. So the scheme for the saturation of America with the Beatles had to depend on people knowing who they were. That's why you had so many people at the airports when they rolled up, because they were there to see the Beatles. And then the resulting Beatlemania would be on the news, and then that news would be widely circulated, and that's how they became household names. If you remove the pomp and circumstance and the media attention that followed, they kind of just show up in America without any fanfare at all. And as a result, can just kind of be left to their own devices. When they came to America, they were kept on a perpetual series of publicity. They were always everywhere. Even before the Ed Sullivan Show, they were on the news.
I can see where you're coming from. I mean, could it have happened that the Beatles could have, you know, could they have been a big band in the UK and other countries without necessarily making it in the US, say, like the Kinks did in some ways?
Well, if you remember, the Kinks did also attempt to invade America a la the Beatles, but they failed miserably just because they did not strike enough of a chord. They didn't have quite the same amount of magic. The Kinks are brilliant, don't get me wrong. I love their music to bits, but they just did not have... The era for a Beatles-esque British invasion had passed by that point.
You're listening to The Alternate History Show with myself, Ben Cairns, and I'm joined by special guest Black and the Borg, a font of all knowledge when it comes to the Beatles, and we'll be exploiting more of that knowledge on the second part of the show, which is coming out very soon after I've done this for you.
The Alternate History Show presents the 60-second summary.
For those who didn't listen to the previous show on World War II, well, I suggest that you do as soon as you can once you've done with this particular program. But for those who didn't listen, this is where I like to summarize a piece of alternate history work so that you can check it out for yourself. I don't want to give too much away, so I give myself 60 seconds to go over the gist of it in an attempt to entice you to its charms. And we'll do a double take, actually, for you on this edition of the show. We'll do a second 60-second summary involving something that our friend Black and the Borg came up with a few years back, and that'll be coming up in about half an hour's time. First of all, to a timeline set up in 2013 on the Alternate History site, alternatehistory.com, called, very simply, Get Back, and unsurprisingly involving the Beatles. And here is the premise. Get Back was set originally in 1968, involving George Harrison speaking up the Quiet Beatle, as he was dubbed. In this timeline, decides to call a crisis meeting regarding Apple. It may surprise you that Harrison did this because he was the least enthusiastic about the project. However, in some ways, this gives him the impetus to put Apple Music on a firmer footing. It does get onto a firmer footing in 1969, leading to a lack of a need to immediately resolve the management crisis, leading to the lack of an Eastman versus Klein battle, and that in turn leads to the Beatles recording well into 1976, although George Harrison does partake in a temporary exodus from the band. And that's what happened. And that's all I can tell you. Right, our magical alternate history tour continues in part two. We'll do another 60-second summary. And also, we will have a look at the man who could have signed the Beatles early in 1962. Dick Rowe in focus. And more from me and Borg in part two of the show coming up.
Alternate History Show with Ben Cairns. In association with alternatehistory.com, the world's premier alternate history discussion site.
A lot of conspiracy theorists find this particularly fertile ground. I do love the conspiracy theories surrounding the supposed death of Paul McCartney. What if the conspiracy theorists were right? What if he did die in that car accident? What would happen to the band?
What do you mean if?
Well, yes.
Deceased. He's not wearing any shoes, it's obvious. I find the concept of not only Paul McCartney dying in 1966 and no one knowing about it, and then subsequently taking part in the most successful cover-up of all time to be like a ridiculous scenario, because considering who Paul McCartney was, if he sneezed, it would be on the news. Like, you think he's going to crash his car and, as some of the some of the rumors note, get decapitated and his hair set on fire? That people would not tack on to that. The excuse they give is that they're brought before MI5 by, like, the Secret Service, and the Secret Service informed them, we are going to cover this up, we are going to replace your man with an identical person, because everyone would be very upset. Their excuse was there could be suicides. So the government was like, this is an issue. We need to figure this out. This is our number one priority. Not the Cold War, not British intelligence, not the Falklands, no.
Devaluation or anything like that, no. It's all about this. It's all about, yeah.
Make sure those girls don't get sad that the music artist has died.
It strikes me as beyond absurd, really. But let's say that he actually did die in 1966, definitively, and there is no question about that. What would happen to the band after that?
Okay, so is the assumption that he dies and there is no cover-up, or...
He just dies. He just dies. There's absolutely no cover-up or anything like that attempted.
There's no Willie Campbell.
Of course. Yeah, of course.
Well, unfortunately for the group, Paul McCartney was an integral component of the band. He's half of Lennon McCartney. He is 1/4 of the Beatles. Without him, I would argue that there is no replacing him. He's integral. He is constant.
Would the Beatles even try and carry on in this scenario?
I wouldn't say that at all, actually. Like, by all means, around that time, the group was so cohesive that if... Okay, like, let's use the example. John Lennon was... He's a sensitive wee soul. When he had people in his life, he would become very attached to them. So to lose someone as significant as Paul McCartney suddenly in a traffic accident, that would probably break the man. He would probably not care anymore about music. He'd probably just hobble himself up. He would just, like, leave the music scene, probably, just because he'd be in such grief for a time. If that makes any sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. It is, I've heard a lot of people... I've heard some people say that.
You're essentially ruining the entire structure of the band. The band cannot stand without all four of its components.
Mm. It's interesting because the following year, of course, Brian Epstein passed away, and the Beatles did carry on for a couple of years afterwards, and John Lennon was fine regarding... Well, not exactly, you know what I mean, anyway.
Fine.
Yeah.
He was very emotionally distraught.
Of course.
You know, Brian was their manager. Mm. Very close.
Mm. But
your... Brian didn't write any songs.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's move on to the aforementioned. Anyway, Brian Epstein. What if he had survived and hadn't taken the overdose, perhaps survived it with minimal damage and was around for the Beatles? In short, did Brian Epstein's demise, did his death lead to the breakup of the band?
Prior to Epstein's death, he was not in a lot of capacities required, because they were growing as artists and had retreated into the studio away from touring. They were mostly dependent on their own actions and didn't require a man to shepherd them about like they would in their touring days. Brian was very good when it came to touring. He was not overtly needed after that. So if he'd survived, he would have mainly just been used as a voice of persuasion, because as both Paul McCartney and John Lennon pointed out after their breakup, after the band's breakup, they did state that Paul attempted to fill the void left by Mr. Epstein, and as a result, he attempted to take de facto control of the group, which didn't sit well with John, and then that created resentment, rah rah rah. So without Epstein's demise, it's entirely possible that the group would have continued. Now, would this necessarily result in a tour? I would not say that at all, but it's entirely possible that band relations would have been improved. I'm not too sure.
One thing that would have been different is I Am the Walrus and all the music after the music such as that, because apparently that was done not long after Epstein's death. So I've heard it said that that would be markedly different if Epstein had survived.
Well, again, Epstein is a contributing force. He essentially corralled the group when they needed direction. So in the vacuum of Epstein's passing, they were essentially left to their own devices and had to stand themselves up. And in that space, they got a lot more experimental and also a lot more divided. So it's entirely possible that he would have put his foot down in a lot of instances. He would say something like, no, you can't do a weird television movie that no one wants to watch. No, you can't make a double album. That sort of thing.
You can't invite your wife into the studio. That kind of, yeah. I mean, would he have said that to John? And, I mean, would they have listened?
But when it came to relationships, Epstein had no power over that. They would do what... You can't stand between a man and his potential life partner.
I'm just wondering, because it did cause controversy, of course, in later years, but that was after, of course, after Mr. Epstein's death. And, relations had broken down a bit by then, of course. Okay, let's move on to another point in time, and you mentioned that weird television show, that weird film that no one wanted to watch. What if everyone had wanted to watch it? What if it had been a raving success, or at least a moderate success by the standards of the Beatles? How would that have affected things? So everything up until that point goes as it did do until the film.
It's an incredibly loaded question, all things considered. There was a lot of nails in the coffin with Magical Mystery Tour. First of all, it did not have a cohesive plot. The entire premise of the film was Paul McCartney did not have a script. He had a schedule and went, okay, from 12 to 2, we'll do this bit, and then from 2 to 4, we'll do John's bit, and then tomorrow morning, we'll do George's bit. Ringo, do you want any bits? You know, that sort of logic.
Yeah.
And as a result, it was very abstract, very odd. It was mainly a collage of music.
Very disjointed, I get what you mean.
The Beatles found entertaining.
Yeah.
There's an entire scene in the film based on a dream that John Lennon had when he was a waiter at a restaurant and he kept shoveling spaghetti onto the plate of a woman. Just more and more spaghetti. And it was a very aimless film, which is one of the reasons that a lot of people who had previously been exposed to the Beatles through their products such as Hard Day's Night and Help, which had, I would argue, more cohesive storylines. When it was given to the BBC for distribution, the film, which, if you remember, is very colourful, very psychedelic, very all over the place, was broadcast entirely in black and white, which muted a lot of the point. You'd have kaleidoscope effects and you'd just be looking at a landscape that was just in black and white.
Yeah.
So a lot of people missed the point on its original broadcast.
Of course, it's very interesting. I mean, could the plot and could the film itself have been more cohesive given a bit more effort?
I don't think so. Like, the premise of the production itself is too far removed from the mainstream for success.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I was just checking, so it would have been interesting. Let's move on now to very much the Annus Horribilis of the Beatles era, 1969. What a year that was. What a year that was. And let's focus on a couple of bits and pieces to do with that year. Let's focus first on Apple Music. Could that have been more successful?
Oh, definitely. Apple had the capability to be an incredibly successful piece. However, the downfall of Apple did not come through its music. It came largely through the other ventures that Apple Corps was involved in. If you remember, in the late 1960s, Apple had a boutique fashion line, they had a technology avenue, they had a film studio, and it was all based around the communal idea of, you don't have to grovel, just come in here, say you have an idea, we'll give you some money and set you on your merry way. More than half the people who came and got investments through the Apple subsidies did not produce the product. They just kind of took the money and ran, because, again, this was the late 60s. This is when it began to curdle. So much so that the boutique went bankrupt within less than a year of its opening, and they just had to let people take stuff for free just so they can liquidate all the stock.
I mean,
so,
it seems like a nice idea in theory, doesn't it? But
in a utopian world where everything's lollipops and rainbows, that definitely would have been nice. Mm. But this was a byproduct of the utopian thinking of the late 90s. It's like, oh, everything's fine, everything's good, humankind is great. But as it turns out, especially in Savile Row, where it did open, people were jerks that just kind of took advantage. There's a particular individual of note here. It's called Magic Alex. He was a Greek Armenian person who had fallen into the Beatles in-group. He was pretty much a con man. His whole thing was he made gadgets, and the Beatles went, oh, we should have an arm of Apple for that. And he didn't give any of his products, like, he just didn't do anything. He was a troublemaker. He started rumors. And he eventually just took a lot of money that really wasn't his.
I must admit, I have heard of Magic Alex, although I can't say I knew too much about him before today. So every day on this show particularly is a school day. Right, shifting on now to Yoko Ono, the woman who perhaps received more opprobrium than, well, a lot of people to do with the Beatles, including Magic Alex, including Alan Klein. So, does she deserve the opprobrium that she gets? In short, I suspect I know what you're going to say to this, but did Yoko Ono break up the Beatles, or is the truth, as I imagine it is, somewhat more nuanced?
It's nuanced as hell, my man. There is not one contributing factor for the breakup of the Beatles. Yoko Ono was, of course, a new factor. However, it was as much John's fault as it was Yoko, because with John, he insisted that she be in the studio. He insisted that she be at their side all the time, because he was developing a new relationship and he wanted to be with her at all times. So it was as much John's change in personality as it was her, but also the reason Mr. Epstein's death is such a contentious issue for the breakup of the band was that he left a power vacuum, and then you had Paul McCartney try and wade around in that power vacuum, and the Beatles weren't too happy about that. And then when they needed a new manager, he volunteered his new in-laws, the father and brother.
Yes, the Eastmans, which we'll come on to a little bit later on, actually.
And this came off as him trying to have absolute control over the group, them, like the manager, the finance, everything. And to counter that, the rest of the Beatles fell in behind Al Klein, who was a bit of a tit, to be perfectly honest. He was
a very mild way of putting it. I've heard a lot of people describe him as far worse.
I don't want to swear on the show.
We better not. But yes, yeah. I'm glad you didn't. But I get exactly what you're saying.
And that formed a whole load more conflicts that arose from that, and it snowballed out of control. If you remove Yoko from the equation, it's entirely possible that Lennon just becomes an unworkable blob who's very upset. Yoko gave him some sort of revitalization with his creative thing. He wanted to be more experimental the entire time he was in the group. And finally, he had someone to enable him in that way, because Yoko was very... she's Yoko. We all know what she's like.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
No offense to the woman, but her screaming idea is still very avant-garde even in 2019.
It probably will be in 2090 as well, I'd imagine.
I would argue that in a way Yoko was majorly a creative influence. She essentially lit a fire from under him, and then he went off going, whoa, revolution number 9, hey, Plastic Ono band, whoa, you know, that sort of angle. Without that, he probably would have just, like, I don't know, become more of a dependent addict to heroin, which he was trying out in the late 60s, and it's entirely possible he would have had an accident had he not had a more dependent entity.
Sort of at the very worst, or at the very best, possibly becoming another Sid Barrett. I've heard a lot of people suggest that could have happened. He could have gone down the Sid Barrett route.
Would have, yes.
Let's focus on, well, the wonderful Alan Klein. Alan Klein. I have actually, I've heard a few good things said about him. By his son.
A few, perhaps.
I have heard it said, though, that Alan Klein...
He's a vegetarian. There's a few things about that as well. Doesn't forgive him.
I have heard it said, though, that Alan Klein famously turned down a meeting with Paul McCartney, and someone tried to surmise that had he accepted the meeting with Paul McCartney, perhaps things may have gone a bit smoother with Alan Klein. Is that an assumption you would agree with?
It's dependent on the angle you're approaching it at, because the contention of Alan Klein wasn't the fact that Alan Klein was a shifty individual. It was the fact that the band were turning against Paul in regards to his ideas.
I'd say it probably didn't help.
The Eastman.
Yeah.
Yeah, it didn't help the fact that Klein was an absolute sod of a man. Mm. But the main issue of contention was he wanted one thing and the entire rest of the group wanted another thing, and neither would budge, and this took a massive toll on the interband relationship.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's entirely possible that if they sat down with Klein, he would have just gone, okay, I understand you more, but I still want my group in charge of...
I'm going to do what I'm going to do, basically.
Paul, for all his pluses, is very steadfast and stubborn when it comes to his decisions.
Sure. It has been argued that he did the right thing with Alan Klein not to trust him, and we could argue till the cows come home, basically. If we're going with an alternative management at this point... Is it completely out of the question that at this stage, given the relationship breakdown between Paul and the rest of the guys, that he could have persuaded the Beatles to throw their lot in with the Eastmans? I'm guessing not going to happen.
Because as previously said, they weren't looking at the Eastmans as individuals. They were looking at the Eastmans as an extra appendage for Paul McCartney's control. They would have refused the Eastmans.
Could there have been a happy medium? Well, not so happy medium, but a medium that people could have, or the band could have worked with. So an alternative to Alan Klein and the Eastmans and, someone else.
That is a very interesting concept, because in history there... Well, by all contemporary accounts, it was either Helen Klein or the Eastmans. It was one or the other.
Yes,
they did not have a third man.
Mm.
So if they had found someone else equally as capable or had Brian still, there would have not been as much conflict, because the conflict was... The Eastmans was Paul's camp and Klein was the other's camp.
Yeah.
It's only that. If you had a third party, they probably would have just gone, oh, okay then.
We'll go with that.
Let's go with him.
So we move on. I mean, what if towards the end of the Beatles' career, Abbey Road, of course, was released before Let It Be? What if it had been the other way around?
Well, Let It Be, prior to... its release, was previously known as Get Back. It was an attempt at a film being made.
Mm.
It was supposed to be an album, but because the sessions were so horrid and so...
Contentious.
Yeah, so contentious that they kind of just moved on from it, but then they realized that they had an entire album they needed to mix. They got Phil Spector. Phil Spector kind of took a big old dump on the whole mix. and then they... moved along. So let's say in this hypothetical, Paul McCartney decides, you know what, we don't need to make a film, let's just do our regular shtick of making an album and do whatever. A lot of the stresses would have probably been removed. Yoko would have still been there, of course, but the external pressures of being watched, as George Harrison put it, like under the microscope, did make it very contentious. So it's entirely possible that Get Back would have just been put out, and then maybe they would have had something vaguely resembling Abbey Road. But there I would agree. It would be like a marginal difference.
Let's move on now and talk about George Harrison, actually, because he wasn't happy towards the end of the Beatles' career due to not being taken seriously as an artist as he saw it. And, of course, he went on to be the very first Beatle to release a solo effort. I mean, what if they had listened to George more often towards the end, towards 1969? And 1970, so you'd have had sort of a rather a songwriting duo, a trio perhaps.
Yeah, the issue with George Harrison's whole thing was Lennon and McCartney were the pre-established head of the group. They were an unwieldy beast when it came to power, and George Harrison cropping up and having his own compositions was a major threat to the pre-established order, which when you have a group like them already under threat because their manager has died and one of them is trying to control the rest, it made a lot of contention. Towards the end of the band's life, however, John Lennon being more relaxed and more, you know, prone to looking at things from outside the box because of Yoko Ono's influence, did agree that George's songs were good. But Paul McCartney was still very apprehensive about that because he saw that as continuing to work against his way of thinking. I think the end result is the group would have still broken up because the main issue of contention was between John and Paul. But I think George would have probably just had a couple more songs on the album. He got a staggering 3 on one album. That was fun. And towards the late 1960s, early 70s, he had a large backlog of songs that were actually fielded to the Beatles, but they ultimately rejected it just because they weren't feeling it.
And much more on the breakup, or the lack of a breakup, evidently, coming up on the Beatles in part 3 of today's Alternate History Show. This is Ben Kearns with you for another 35 minutes or so. And we now come to the point in the show where we look at one person's brush with infamy. And I suppose that this feature shouldn't be called Almost Infamous in this instance. It should be called Almost Infamous for a completely different reason. And today we're focusing on the man who decided to turn down the opportunity to sign the Beatles, as we discussed earlier on in the programme. But who was Dick Rowe? Well, I'm about to tell you. Dick Paul Rowe was born on June the 9th, 1921, and became the head honcho for Decca Records. He was very much their singles man. In 1962, he was sent a 15-track audition from the then Silver Beatles, as they were known at the time. However, he famously allegedly replied to Brian Epstein, saying, "Mr. Epstein, I'm afraid guitar bands are falling out of favour." Little did he know, eh? Well, it turned out that he was less hostile to the idea of signing the Beatles than imagined, as he'd already signed Brian Poole and the Tremolos, who at the time enjoyed slightly greater success before 1962 than the Fab Four. You wouldn't think it now, but apparently that did happen. Mr. Rowe's other highlights, so to speak, include signing the Rolling Stones. He even signed some bands on the advice of George Harrison in later years, ironically. Before that, though, he produced a Christmas album for Dickie Valentine, and How Much Is That Doggy in the Window by Lita Rosa. Next time you hear that song, think of Dick Rowe, but not too much, because everyone makes mistakes, let's face it. He was also vocal in signing artists such as Tom Jones in later life as well, in the 60s. Dick Rowe died following complications from diabetes in 1986. He was somewhat sanguine and fairly quiet about his brush with infamy, as you're probably no doubt unsurprised to know.
So there you go. That's the life and times of Dick Rowe. And let's move on now to another piece of alternate history to do with the Beatles.
The Alternate History Show presents the 60-second summary.
And it's the second one of these for today's show. We are in the middle of our conversation, of course, with Black and the Borg regarding the Beatles and What If discussions. So it's only fitting that we come to his timeline on the Beatles that he wrote, entitled It's All Too Much. You'll find it on the alternate history site, alternatehistory.com, once again. And here is the lowdown on it, as far as I see it. It's All Too Much starts with the premise of Lennon taking a bit too much LSD, leading to an earlier Savile Row performance. This does, however, have the effect of revitalizing Lennon's creativity earlier, meaning he is more psyched up for the idea of going to India and rubbing shoulders with Ravi Shankar than he was. This does also mean that he still meets Yoko Ono. However, the Beatles do break up temporarily. However, their breakup is only temporary due to Yoko Ono's earlier pregnancy. And they reunify in 1971 with a somewhat impromptu performance at the Bangladesh concert. And the rest, as they say, is history. Leave them getting back together in the early 70s and producing some new material. And I've overlapped with my 60 seconds. Right, the Alternate History Show continues in part three. We'll be talking about more Beatles as we come onto the split. And we'll be changing tack slightly with Alex Wallace in about 10 minutes' time as well, 10 minutes into part three, with the Feedback Hub. And we'll look at how a potential Delta involving a science fiction novel could have prevented the formation of the State of Israel 46 years later, as we know it anyway. That's coming up in part three.
It's history with a twist. You're listening to the Alternate History Show with Ben Kearns.
Well, let's move on to the split now, which was permanent, as we know. Well, pretty much permanent, barring a sort of reunion in the mid-90s and, you know, sort of getting back together at various interludes. Could a situation have been arranged, say, where the Beatles decided to record separate solo albums and then come back together sporadically at various points, or perhaps the other way around? So with the group the majority of the time and branching out for solo efforts occasionally, could that have happened as late as 1969?
Like if they had a third eye, like instead of Klein or the Eastmans, if they had a third person or a Brian to sit them down and go, okay, you're clearly at each other's throats, let's have a sabbatical, and then let's get, if we want to get back together, we can. But because it was so contentious and hot-blooded at the time, and because they were seen as a unit entirely up until they disintegrated, I don't think the idea of a solo Beatles were exactly palatable to the listener. They would have been like, what's this? I thought they were a band. What's going on? They were a unit. You had to sell them as all four, not as one each. If they sat down and went, okay, we have to make some solo albums, I think it could be possible. It's just how that comes about is a more broad question. And whether or not the suggestion of this would even be successful in coming together.
You know, even if they had arranged something like that at the time, had some sort of arrangement, then, yeah, I suppose Wings could be could be a bit busy, and then John would be in the States or whatever, and that could cause a few eruptions.
Wings was produced as a compensatory thing by Paul.
Yeah, yeah.
Noticed that his solo material wasn't going very well, so he thought, I can start a new band.
Yeah.
And he did.
Yeah.
John started his group, the Plastic Ono Band, as an art project, so it wasn't really an issue whether or not who was in it. It was just mainly the backing group.
Yeah.
George Harrison, to my knowledge, just had his mates around, like John, who didn't really have like a cohesive band. And Ringo was just Ringo. He was just doing whatever.
Including the rating train stories.
Well, he didn't do that until the late 80s.
No, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I'm jumping ahead slightly. Let's talking of jumping ahead. Let's go to 1975 now, and let's discuss the Lost Weekend. Apparently, it looked like a reunion was tentatively, possibly, maybe on the cards. John and Paul were at least conversing in a civil manner, at least, or at least fairly civil at that point. And this was 1975, while John was separated from Yoko Ono. Could the Lost Weekend have turned into a lost week, a lost month, and, well, a lost eternity with a Beatles reunion?
I do actually happen to know a particular tidbit of information that I read.
Share.
In a biography.
Share.
There was a time, May Pang states till this day, that John was intent on visiting Paul McCartney, who had recently brought a villa in, I believe, California. It may have been another part of the United States entirely. But he had brought a new house, and John, in his new way of thinking, because he was, you know, separated from Yoko, went, you know, I'm going to go visit him. I'm going to surprise him. I'm going to hang out with him, and maybe, I don't know, what happens, happens. And then, catching wind of this, because the relationship was still very codependent, Yoko had a appointment set up with a hypnotherapist and went, oh, yeah, this is because John needs to quit smoking. Smoking's bad for him. And May Pang did not trust this, but essentially John was like, you know what, I may as well go. And then he went, and then for two whole days, nothing was heard of the two. John would not answer any calls. Yoko would also not answer her, like, office numbers. And then at the end of that period, John came back to May Pang. He was not smoking. However, he said, look, I've decided to go back to Yoko. That does sound like a conspiracy theory, but that is her account of how the situation went. And then he went back to Yoko. Yoko became pregnant with their first son, Sean. Everything was history, pretty much. So it's entirely possible if John looks at the bit of paper saying, come to this hypnotherapy session, it'll be totally cool, if he just kind of chucked that in the bin and was like, you know, I'm my own man now, I don't need mother, I'm cool, he probably would have gone back together in a band capacity with Mr. McCartney. There probably would have been a reunion on the cards. George Harrison was, I would argue, if John, Paul, and Ringo were all good with it, George would be the problem, because he was he was still very hung up over the bitterness between the group.
But would the Beatles sans George Harrison be the Beatles, I suppose?
No.
And who would take Ed in to replace him if George says, I don't want to do it?
Then they don't do it, I think, because, again, they're a group. You can't subtract. I mean, the Freetles only exists in our history because John Lennon happened to be assassinated and they got together using songs he had previously written as basis. So in absence of Harrison in this group, they would have just been mates hanging out. I don't think they would have even fielded the idea of an album.
Could George have been persuaded? I agree with what you said about the fact that he was the most difficult persuade at this point.
McCartney was the issue, because whilst John was kind of laissez-faire with his songs, he's just like, okay, you can do them or don't do them, I don't really mind, I think they're fine. Paul was seen as the all-controlling mastermind behind the scenes. He was the reason that Harrison's songs didn't get on the albums. He was the reason the band broke up. So if Paul sat down with George and went, look, mate, I am so sorry, and groveled, it probably would have resulted in George being like, okay, but only if I get like a 60-40 song balance on this album we're doing.
I want my say, and things are going to change, basically. What's the probability or the possibility of Paul actually doing that, do you reckon?
If the other two were into it but then realised that Paul would have been the problem, they probably would have gone together and said, listen, Paul, you need to have a sit down with Georgie. We're all mates. If you just talk it out, it would have been very cathartic, surely.
We're going to have to go in a sec. First of all, had John Lennon not been assassinated, what would he have done? Yoko Ono seems to think he would have done club music. Would there have been a Beatles reunion on the cards?
That's the greatest what-if question of all.
It is. And I'm posing
it. Up, like, if you could go back in time, what would you change, kind of question. I think with John, he was coming back into the spotlight. That was true. He had just put out his Double Fantasy album.
Yeah.
And
It was not doing well in the charts, admittedly. It was at number 34 the day of his death, and it, of course, shot up to number one because of, you know, unfortunate events. So I think met with middling album sales and also the end of a lot of hostilities between the group, there may have been some sort of initiative. Again, it is dependent on paths taken in history. I would not necessarily guarantee a Beatles reunion, but it is entirely possible that John would have just continued on making a couple of albums, making public appearances, that sort of thing.
He had the money to do it, of course. He had the money to do it, and they didn't have to worry on that regard, I suppose. Gotta say a massive thank you to Borg for the past hour and a bit talking about the Beatles and trying to help us deduce what may have happened in alternate scenarios with the band and regarding the music industry generally as well. Excellent stuff, truly was. This is Ben Kearns with the Alternate History Show with you for another 15 minutes or so. We're not done yet, not by a long shot, and we are going to fill the next quarter of an hour up, no problem, by trying to elicit your responses.
This is the Feedback Hub.
And joining me today once again for today's Feedback Hub is Alex Wallace, our roving reporter, so to speak, perhaps. Hello, Alex.
Hello, Ben. Nice to be here again.
It is nice to have you again. It really is. So you've been fairly busy on some fronts. We are going to be talking a little bit later on about the revamp of alternate timelines when I come on to that. But you've been quite busy in the background, haven't you? You've been quite busy reading some alternate history material. So what is your... Let's come on to your alternate history pick of the week straight away.
So, this is a book that is strange in its historical context, but is
right
interesting enough that I think it's worth bringing up, and it's like Orwell's 1984 in that it's more honorary alternate history, because it was written in 1902.
Right.
Okay, so I needed to give it the background to this book, like how I found it,
yeah,
which is why I found it so interesting. So I was reading this anthology of Israeli science fiction and fantasy a couple months ago.
Okay.
And in its introduction, it's giving a history of Jewish science fiction. And they make the very interesting argument that the modern state of Israel was inspired by a science fiction novel.
And they come to that conclusion how exactly?
In 1902, famous Zionist Theodor Herzl wrote a book called The Old New Land in German Altneuland, which from the vantage point of 1902 speculates what a Jewish colonized Palestine will look like in the 1920s.
Right.
It uses this frame narrative of one Jew and one Gentile going on this world tour, and they visit Palestine in 1902, and they go live on a desert island for 20 years, and then they come back to Palestine, and the Jews have settled there, and he uses it to not so subtly pontificate about what he thinks best practice for a Jewish state would be. Keep in mind, this guy died well before 1948.
I was going to say, did any of his descendants perhaps live to see the creation of modern-day Israel, and what did they make of it?
I don't know about descendants, but there were plenty of people he knew that would later go on to be imported in early modern Israel, like Chaim Weizmann. He was a member of Herzl's organization and later became the first president of Israel. And, I mean, this book is very important in the history of Zionism. If you translate the name Old New Land into Hebrew, that name is Tel Aviv.
Ah.
That's what the city is named after, this book, and this book's version of a Jewish state in Palestine and that utopian ideology that runs through it.
Mm. And so it gets you thinking that, you know, had that not been written, Israel, as we know it at the very least, wouldn't exist. or possibly couldn't exist. Possibly. Maybe that is a topic for a future show as well, the lack of a state of Israel or alternate Israels and when they could have been formed, perhaps. All right, my pick of the week is an interesting thread I was reading, actually, on alternate timelines. I was on alternate timelines the other day, having a bit of a skim through some of them. I came across one quite interesting one about King Charles the 12th of Sweden and a timeline that is being sort of created. I'm sort of at the beginning of it anyway, but there was a timeline being created on that very subject, a more militarily successful Charles the 12th of Sweden. I don't know whether you come across that yet or not, Alex, on alternate timelines.
I think I've seen it. I haven't really looked through it because I'm not really familiar with that era of Swedish history other than Sabaton's Carolus Rex.
Yes.
So I need to look at that, do a bit more reading on the subject, and then I can probably appreciate it better.
Yeah, it's one of those quite underrated points of departure, I reckon. It's one of those ones that you may not necessarily think of, and I didn't know too much about it beforehand, so it was, as a lot of alternate histories can be, very educational as well. I was reading the Fru Darkest Europe, the Turtle Dove novel that came out very recently, and I have been looking as well a little bit more than I have at the Cross Time Traffic series of books, which has been interesting. Someone I've been I've wanted to read for a while. I've been umming and ahhing over it, but yeah, it's happened. It finally happened over the past couple of weeks or so. All right, Alex, is there anything else of significance that you want to point out during this particular segment?
I've just been reading some other alternate history stuff, and this is another book I haven't seen mentioned much, Another Girl, Another Planet by Lou Antonelli.
Ah, I know the song. I know the song, Another Girl, Another Planet, but not necessarily the book. Tell us more about it.
It's set in a world in which, after World War II, the Americans and the Soviets decide to compete via the space race instead of, carving up the world and having proxy wars. And so, by this world's 1988, there is a Mars colony.
Right.
And it revolves around the newly appointed American governor of Mars having to deal with robots and with other social issues, which I won't state because that would be a very major spoiler of the plot. So I actually have been in the presence of Mr. Antonelli. I was at RavenCon in Williamsburg, Virginia a couple years ago, and one of my friends, Sean Korsgaard, was on a panel, and one of the other guys on the panel was Mr. Antonelli.
Oh.
So that book was in the back of my mind for about 2 or 3 years now, and so
So you sort of knew of him at the time, but you've been wanting to read it for a while, and now you finally got around to it.
Yes, I did, and it was a very pleasant surprise. I strongly recommend it to anyone who likes alternate space ages or old science fiction, or what I'm tempted to call cassette futurism or formica punk, as TV Tropes likes to call it. That sort of So you know how steampunk is a weird, exaggerated Victorian times?
Yes, yes, yeah.
Diesel punk is weird, exaggerated, World War eras. Atom
sort of
punk
on steroids.
Is the 50s on steroids.
Yeah.
So what's been called cassette futurism or formica punk is 70s to about 60s or maybe 90s on steroids. It's a future run on analog computers. Old Star Trek, or I don't know, and for a more recent example, all the government labs and Stranger Things have that look, kind of, so that's the sort of aesthetic of this book.
Yeah.
Which I think was interesting and not done very much, so I definitely recommend it if that sounds interesting.
Yeah, no, that sounds very interesting. Not only for, I suppose, what would happen in, you know, to space and space exploration, but I suppose to the rest of the world as well, as more attention is turned to the space race. I suppose a lot of it, there was some attention, a great deal, particularly in the 60s, in real life, in OTL, but yeah, more space race attention is, it's an interesting prospect. Potentially. Yeah, very interesting prospect. And I do wonder what that would do to the image, perhaps, of the US and the USSR in the intervening years as well, had that happened. Just to check on how the alternate timelines redevelopment, rehashing of the website is going, everything all right on that score? Any news that we should be aware of?
We are currently undergoing a streamlining of how the forums are organized, a lot of copy editing in our forum descriptions, and it's still an ongoing initiative. We're still taking feedback from users. Hell, we'll probably take feedback from random people who visit.
Right.
And just generally trying to prepare the forum for the new decade of the Alden History community, which I think is going to be distinctly different from the community that I joined in about 2012, late 2011.
Right.
So I think we're just trying to prepare for the challenges of the new decade and for a community that is not defined by the same things it was when I joined.
Okay. So, and what are the changes? What are the changes that you've seen in the past 8 years? And how is it going to affect new users and users of the forum generally? What's going to be the major difference that people are going to see when they click online?
We're just, at the moment, trying for a more streamlined site, trying for a more easily navigable site. I mean, I think the bulk of the proposals I submitted to Roll have already been made. And I think that the site looks a lot cleaner.
Mm.
Since those edits, I think it looks more professional. Looks better to the newcomer.
Mm.
So, which is like was the entire intention of the proposals, like make us look like a more legit AH site, which we're trying to be. We are currently undergoing a streamlining of how the forums are organized. A lot of copy editing in our forum descriptions. And it's still an ongoing initiative. We're still taking feedback from users. Hell, we'll probably take feedback from random people who visit.
Right.
And just generally trying to prepare the forum for the new decade of the Alden History community, which I think is going to be distinctly different from the community that I joined in about 2012, late 2011.
Right.
So I think we're just trying to prepare for the challenges of the new decade and for a community that is not defined by the same things it was when I joined.
Okay. So, and what are the changes? What are the changes that you've seen in the past 8 years? And how is it going to affect new users and users of the forum generally? What's going to be the major difference that people are going to see when they click online?
We're just, at the moment, trying for a more streamlined site, trying for a more easily navigable site. We were doing this in part to either complement or compete with whichever we feel like using at the moment, with stuff like Sea Lion Press.
Yep.
or the War and Peace section of Sufficient Velocity. And we're like angling for that smaller market, the sort of people who like that small, more cozy forum.
Yeah.
As opposed to the behemoth that is AH.com.
yes.
And
of course, you got the Facebook page as well, Alternate History Online. So that's you've got a thing. You've got your fingers, as I say, in a lot of pies. So that's all good. How is the forum looking at the moment, and what do you aim to be doing in the future? Basically, how long is this going to take, do you think?
At the moment, Roll has been very efficient in getting a lot of the things I wanted him to do done, and it's a lot of the grammar editing is better, and some forums I consider to be redundant have been folded into proper forums, and hoping it's like done by the new year. And in terms of what's coming next, one of the things I've thrown by him is resurrecting the old blog that he used and turning it into something that fills the niche that Matt Mitrovich's old Alternate History Weekly update once did.
Right.
So that might be something we're doing, something I'm encouraging him to do, and I would like to take community submissions, much like Matt did. I had a few pieces of put on the weekly update during his time.
Okay. Yeah, it was very interesting, actually. You have mentioned this over the past few months that you're planning to do a blog, so we will have our fingers crossed that that gets up and running very, very soon, and say people will flock to that, and we will mention it on this show, of course, when it does happen. We will mention it when it does happen. What else has been going on? How's the Facebook page looking at the moment? What have you been up to on Alternate History Online?
It's been business as usual, good discussion. The last really great post, I think, was a few months ago, really going into detail into looking into how Rhodesia could have survived.
Ah, right, okay.
But not as a white nationalist fever dream.
Yeah.
And the basic idea was it had to kill a lot of people and it'd be kind of a dystopian nightmare.
Yeah, yeah, it was other kind of appropriate, kind of timely that this happens, that you mentioned this, really, I suppose, with the death of Mugabe, of course, last month. There's some good feedback on the first of these shows that we did regarding the Second World War, which I'm pleased to say went down relatively well.
Good feedback, constructive stuff. Some other people who want to be on the show. And then that invitation goes to everyone listening to this. If there's something you want to discuss here, we are happy to take you on.
Yeah. And even if there's nothing in particular that you want to discuss, if you're thinking, you know, I love history, I love alternate history, but I can't think of anything at the moment that I specifically want to discuss, then just simply tell us what you're interested in, that kind of stuff. I'm present on Alternate Timelines now. I've joined the Alternate History Facebook page. I'm available on alternatehistory.com, and Alex is around on all those sites as well. And we want to hear from you. We want to hear what you, basically a few guidelines as to what you're interested in, if nothing else. So maybe you're interested in 18th century Austria, perhaps. I don't know. I had a couple of interesting suggestions as well as to what we could be doing in the future. So watch this space. Alex, you're joining in with one that we are doing very, very soon about the Cold War going hot, potentially.
Yes, my understanding is that will be in December.
Had a couple of other ideas about potential ideas that we could do in the future. Of course, 2020, as we all know, and as you probably know better than me, Alex, is an election year in the US. So a lot of people have been suggesting that we do JFK surviving, that kind of stuff, and surviving with perhaps with a twist, with brain damage perhaps, or not winning in 1960, and loads of other bits and pieces. I came up with the idea of doing 1968 and all that as well. That's quite an interesting topic, in my opinion. And we got a few ideas which we are currently kicking around, and we will come back to. I do want to do something, I have to say, in the near future, probably March, April time, I reckon. Regarding the Hanoverians, I think. The Hanoverians would be quite nice. And I do think, actually, thinking about Rhodesia and Zimbabwe, it will be quite a good thing to do something on that at some stage, I think. Okay.
Something involving, like, 20th century African history would be interesting.
Yes, we do need to do that more, I think. There is, it's got a lot of potential to affect, not only Africa, but the Western world, but it is perhaps rarely touched upon. Maybe, unless something comes up, you know, you get the Mugabe being deposed and dying and that kind of stuff, and then you do get a bit of a spike of interest. But outside of that, sometimes it is, it doesn't often get talked about. So we will definitely be doing something on that in the coming few months or so. Okay, we're coming towards the end of today's Alternate History Show. It only remains for me to say a couple of housekeeping bits and pieces. pieces before we're done. Just to remind you, I am available on many, many different platforms. I am around on the alternatehistory.com website. Check me out there, ah.com, if you want to find out more. Also on Alternate Timelines, you can also check me out on the Facebook page, Alternate History Online, and you can find out more on Sufficient Velocity. And I am available on the Sea Lion Press forums as well. I've just recently signed up to there, so you can contact me in any of those ways about pretty much anything to do with the show, really. If you have an idea for a future show, if you'd like to correspond with me and comment on what you thought of the Beatles program that has just been, or the previous episode on World War II, or maybe you want to float some ideas about future programs, perhaps you want to appear as a guest, maybe you just want to contribute in spirit, or maybe you want to get in contact to tell me that you had a poster of Brian Wilson on your bedroom wall as a teenager. And if you're wondering why I'm asking you to get in contact about that, listen to part one of the show more clearly, because you probably haven't. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to Borg for the Beatles knowledge that he imparted, and of course to Alex, and most importantly for you guys for listening. Do join me in December when we'll do another alternate history show. And on the next show, what if the two tribes really did go to war during the Cold War, and other nuclear scenarios? That'll be in December. Until then, see ya.